Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Voice of Tangaroa is a collaboration between New Zealand Geographic and RNZ. Reporting for this series is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air.
Everything's been, you know, depleted. The only thing that really can survive is the kinners.
Kinna, after they have eaten all of the kelp and turned it into a barren, they suffer as well.
There's virtually nothing in it. Where are you? You can barely even find the row on this one.
The connection for me is it's emotional, but also it's a part of our diet as Māori.
When the kelp grew back, I literally cried.
Kia ora anō, nō mai harumai. Welcome back to Voice of Tangaroa, a collaboration between Our Changing World
and New Zealand Geographic.
In this series, we explore the state of our oceans
and the extraordinary variety of life that calls it home. Ko Kate Evans tēnei, freelance science journalist.
Ko Claire Kinkanana ho, presenter and producer of Our Changing World. In this episode, Kate brings us the complicated and growing problem of kinna barrens, where unchecked proliferation of these spiky urchins decimates seaweed or macroalgae habitats.
Yeah, you could say that we ate our way into this problem, and I wanted to ask whether we could eat ourselves back out of it.
How?
We'll get to that. First, we're heading out to sea with fisherman Peter Herbert, known to everyone as Herb.
Got your dukkah, got your kit.
It's a calm and sunny morning in the Coromandel. We've anchored off the southeastern tip of Hāhei Beach, and as the tinny rocks gently in the small swell, Herb slides off the side.
Barely a splash.
Herb is a commercial kinna fisherman and has been doing this since the early 1990s. He's pretty much the commercial kinna fisherman. He owns around 80% of the kinna quota in the North Island and leases most of the rest from iwi quota owners. You're only allowed to fish for kinna by freediving, so there's no scuba gear here, just snorkel, wetsuit, weight belt, bag to collect the kinna, and an odd-looking two-pronged metal claw with a handle.
What's the tool called that we've been using?
A dukkah, because when you're collecting them, it goes, duk, 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 duk.
Or in my case, duk, and then I have to swim back up.
Normally, Herb dives on healthy reefs where he knows the kinna will be full of bright, foamy roe, the animal's eggs or sperm that some people love to eat. But not today.
So we're on pretty much a barren.
Environmental scientist Johnny Wright is also here diving for kinna.
The dark patch here with the seaweed is the very top of the reef, and then it's quite a flat reef that goes down to what, kind of 6-7 metres at the deepest?
6-7 metres, yeah.
Yeah. So the reef, that we've been fishing off previously is all around this area here, and it's almost completely kind of absent of any kind of macroalgae. So there's a bit of kind of tufting filamentous algae kind of covering the rocks, and bugger all else, to be honest. Not much happening apart from skinny kinna.
We're floating above a kinna barren, an area of the reef where huge numbers of urchins have chomped away the entire kelp forest and now lie in wait, ready to scrape off every new frond that unfurls. They're the destructive agents, but also the victims. In these underwater deserts, urchins can persist for decades in a kind of zombie half-life, eating little and not producing much roe. Later, Johnny pulls one off a healthier area of reef to show me what they should look like.
So you can see here some relatively large roe. It bounces around a bit in terms of the colour. but definitely kind of a darker brown, kind of yellow here. Yeah, but it looks in pretty good condition. How big would you say that is, Herb?
Oh, that'd probably be maybe a 5%, maybe 5.5%.
Yeah.
It's certainly, at this time of year, for us, that is actually worth harvesting.
It's a decent amount of food in there.
Yeah, it's good.
Tastes all right. Do you want to show me a Baron's Kinner for comparison?
So this is that guy from the Baron. You can see there's virtually nothing in it. Where are you? You can barely even find the row on this one.
I can't see anything of golden yellow colour.
This guy is completely empty. That's what you get, you know, with the Baron urchins. They just, you know, they overrun the place. They consume all the algaes in the food, and they effectively, really starve themselves.
So there's too many kinner. They run out of food, but then they just kind of hang on.
Yeah, that's it. Other creatures would die off, but they go into this weird low-energy version of themselves where they're starving, so they barely make any roe, but somehow they continue to exist. And in the last 4 or 5 years, Herb has seen a massive expansion of kinner barrens in the areas near where he fishes. And divers, fishers and iwi report the same in other parts of the country, from the Bay of Islands to the Marlborough Sounds.
And why? Like, who or what is to blame for this?
Well, it's us, because the kinner's natural enemies are also our favourite dinner.
The reason why we have so many kinner is because we have lost a lot of our large predators, so the large snapper, the large crayfish that can predate on them.
University of Auckland marine scientist Kelsey Miller has been studying the kinner barrens in the Hauraki Gulf. We don't know how many kinner are out there, or know precisely how far these barrens are spreading, but Kelsey's done some back-of-the-envelope calculations that hint at the scale of the problem. In 2022, University of Auckland master's student Lisa Dartnell mapped the shallow rocky areas around Hauturu or Toi, Little Barrier Island, and estimated there are about 12 million kinner across 3 square kilometres of barrens.
The amount of kinner at Little Barrier in barrens alone is over tenfold the total allowable commercial catch for all of Sur 1B.
Sur 1B is an area in the quota management system that stretches from Mangawhai to the Bay of Plenty. And Kelsey is just talking about the kinner in barrens around this one tiny island, this little 30-kilometre squared blip on the map in the Hauraki Gulf.
If you were to go around the island and cull all of the kinner, it would probably take around 15,000 hours, diver hours. Or if you collect them, probably around 30,000 hours.
That's insane. If you were to do it, one person nonstop, that's 3.4 years. 3.4 years. How did she work that out?
The numbers are based on her own experience culling smaller areas of kinner. She's been investigating what happens when you remove kinner from barrens, which is actually good news.
Across the Hauraki Gulf, when we remove kinner, macroalgae comes back on its own very fast. Hmm. So we've removed kinner from 4 large areas, so 1.5 to 2 hectares each. And within 2 years, we have almost 45% canopy cover of kelp and fucoids that have come back on their own. So no seeding. We also didn't do any more kinner removal. So seeing if these big areas can restrict the kinner coming back in. So what we see from this is there is a huge potential for restoration.
Well, partially good news.
At all 4 of my sites across the Gulf, there is so much commercial and recreational fishing within these sites. And not surprisingly, we haven't seen an increase in large snapper and crayfish. Only 2 sites did we see any crayfish at. And so a lot of people have this idea that when we restore the habitat, we get all of these species back. But unfortunately, they're limited by overfishing rather than habitat.
So getting rid of the kinner is only part of it.
Yeah, but today we're going to park that wider issue of overfishing.
Just forget about it?
Not forget about it. We can't forget about it, but just shuffle it to the side for now. Instead, we're considering the question, could this environmental problem be turned into an economic opportunity? Could these skinny zombie kina on the Kina Barrens be harvested, fattened up in tanks and sold to a roe-loving East Asian market, making money and helping kelp all at the same time? Johnny Wright works with Envirostrat, who, in collaboration with Ngāti Piro Seafoods and the international startup Urchinomics, is piloting the Kinonomics project to test this idea in New Zealand. That's why he and Herb and Johnny's Envirostrat colleague Liam Hansard have been out collecting underfed kina off the Barrens.
Are you all going down at once?
Yeah.
And you, and what's the aim? Just fill a sack and
fill
then swim back up?
Fill a sack, yeah. They're called kits. So hopefully we can get about 100 skinny kina to a kit. 10 kits. That's 1,000. That's the goal, right? If we can do that quick, then that'd be good.
So go back to the cafe and have a coffee.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so you'll be going down a couple of times?
Yeah, we're going, like me, I'll be going down because probably spend half the, you know, probably most of the day to get my 1,000, but, you know, old Herb over there could probably do it in 3 breaths, so.
It's not long before Herb comes back up and hauls a full bag into the boat.
Perfect.
He takes a few breaths, swaps out his full kit for an empty, and he's back down again. I have a quick go with the dukkha, but it's hard. I can't hold my breath for long enough. So instead, I'm put to work as a kina minder and damp sack wrangler.
So what we do once we kind of get them up to the boat, we keep them in the kit bags, so these netted bags. And we want to keep them out of the wind and as humid as possible. So we use these coffee sacks. We soak them in seawater. We basically layer them over the top, and it's been a tried and true technique.
Why don't they like the wind?
Oh, they dry out pretty quickly. And, you know, we've found that that influences the survivorship over time. So it's really important to kind of, like I said, you know, keep them damp and keep them out of the wind as much as possible. So Hessian sack, and then when you're fully transporting them, wrapping them with a tarp. They're generally pretty good.
Yeah. Hey, little kina. Oh, they're waving their little spines around.
Yeah, yeah, so they're very much alive. Mm. Trying to figure out what's going on, but, you know, these are... And they're very resilient too. I mean, they'll stay alive for a really long time, which is the beauty of kina.
They need to be hardy because their next step is a 10-hour road trip to Wellington to kina fattening camp. Back on land, Johnny fills me in.
They'll be enhanced, they'll be fed our Urchinomics diet over the next 12 weeks. And by the end, they'll be nice, plump, juicy kina, ready to taste at our next expert tasting panel.
Wait, what's an Urchinomics diet? A new health fad or something?
No, it's a good name though, isn't it? Like Kinonomics. Anyway, Urchinomics is the parent company driving this dual idea of restoration and profit, and it's their secret urchin food recipe that the New Zealand kina will be fed. Mostly, they say, this is made from Japanese kombu kelp to appeal to the East Asian palate, where urchin roe is generally called uni, after the Japanese word for it.
The taste has been a real problem, so, you know, that's what we're looking to resolve, you know, with the Urchinomics diet.
They don't like the taste of our kina.
They don't like the taste of our wild-caught kina, which is, you know, it's hard for us to take as New Zealanders, but they've certainly got their own kind of cultural preferences, and they do like a sweeter, more intense uni compared to our, I suppose, relatively bitter, depending on where you get it and depending on what time of the year.
Is it to do with the taste of our kelp, our clonia?
Yeah. I think some parts, certainly, you know, it's... You know, that has an impact, but even between males and females.
Huh. Oh, yeah, because I guess the roe of one is sperm and the roe of the other one is egg.
Yeah, so you have to put them under a microscope to look at the cells to see if they're they're a boy or a girl, basically.
Wow.
But yeah, often the females are relatively bitter compared to the males. So, you know, there's lots of variability. Variability is the only constant in urchins and urchin enhancement.
And not just male versus female, but also seasonal changes and differences in roe colour depending on where kina are sourced from. Not ideal when you're developing a commercial product. Chef Makoto Tokuyama of Kokoro Japanese Restaurant in Auckland agrees. I caught up with him at the end of one of the tasting sessions.
I tried this a lot of times for New Zealand wild kina, but the problem is like the inconsistency of the quality.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, it's really hard to manage for the restaurant.
A kennet tasting session sounds rowdy there.
It's quite an involved process, actually. They gather a panel together to blind taste kinna and ask them to make detailed remarks on an 8-page questionnaire.
8 pages?
I know. The idea is to make it as objective as you can for something as subjective as taste. And they ask them to mark on the colour and the texture too. The noise in the background is the rest of the panel. There were 3 other Japanese chefs, a Taiwanese kiwi food exporter, a food critic, a Māori kina lover from Auckland, and Herb's son and business partner, Todd Herbert. Makoto thinks the Urchinomics-fed kina show promise in terms of consistency, but he'd like them to have a stronger flavour.
I'm Japanese, yeah. So I have so many uni experience. Uni means kina, so then usually uni should possess are more like sweetness, creaminess, richness, and umami. People expect it for kina, so that's why it's like a kina is like a culinary like luxury. So which means like kina must be have like impact.
For Anahira Rawiri of Ngāti Whātua, the local tester, kina was a big part of her upbringing.
I was the little girl who would sit on the boat or on the rocks and kina would just come to me. My cousins were the divers, my dad was the diver, and I suppose it's a nostalgic activity from childhood, but it's maintained itself as a regular feature on our dinner tables since I was a little girl. So I think the connection for me is it's emotional, but also it's a part of our diet as Māori.
She thinks the project has got potential and she's a fan of the dual benefits.
The sustainability aspect of it is appealing to me, and I think even in terms of Ngāti Porou Seafoods has invested in this partnership, and I sort of think that's such an innovative move for a coastal iwi to do something like that.
The tasting panel has been given a short training in advance of this testing. Their palates calibrated to identify astringency, saltiness, sweetness and umami. But when it comes to kina, Anahira knows exactly what she likes.
To me, a good kina is, I mean, I'm a bit biased because I feel like I have had the best kina, and those kina are between Coromandel and Northland.
Oh yeah, specifically?
Specifically for me. I think that's the flavour profile that I like. I always pair myself up with a cousin that likes the yellow ones because I prefer the brown ones, and so that's sort of like the way we divvy up who gets what, in a way. I like my kind of creamy. I'm not too fussed on the colour, but tend to go towards the browner colour so rather than the bright orange.
It's not universal that people prefer the bright orangey ones.
No, I don't like the brown. So.
Mm. Do you prefer it because you think they taste different, or because
I think they taste different? Yeah. Yep, they taste different to me. I'd always discard the yellow ones and push them to the side for someone else, usually my mum. But I know for the tests that we've done today, the people here preferred the brighter yellow ones, and earlier on our first taste test, it was signified something very different for them in their culture, and that's what the colour was attributed to. Well, that's what they said, is that the colour was attributed to things like gold, which is, you know, prosperous and rich.
It's a symbolic meaning
yeah, for different parts of Asia.
Did you taste them? Do you like kina?
I had actually never tasted them before, so Todd Herbert insisted I give it a go.
But I feel scared. So, do I just, like, eat the whole thing?
Yeah.
Should I chew it?
Otherwise, you won't have it too much.
Okay. Well, yeah. It's kind of like a mussel.
Yeah. There's some nuts in this.
Yeah, and there's, like, definitely that sea ocean taste.
Sulfury?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of sulfur. It's got like quite a long aftertaste, hey? Mm. Mm. But I don't hate it.
No.
I thought I would hate it more. It's quite like, it just tastes like eating the sea. Hmm.
I don't hate it is not really a stunning endorsement, Kate.
No, I think it would be different if you had a really strong childhood association with it. But I don't. I didn't eat a lot of kaimoana growing up. I guess I'm not the target market. But high-quality uni, kinero, can reach more than $300 per kilo in Japan, and the taste for it is growing in other Asian countries such as Korea and Taiwan. So for now, the pilot is focused on that. Can they crack the taste and consistency and make the economics of feeding kina in tanks work? Here's Johnny again.
If you can't set up an enhancement operation for a profit, you know, you're never going to get the secondary benefits of kelp restoration or, you know, the social benefits and community benefits of new jobs and whatnot. So we really, you know, that's the first hurdle.
And the second hurdle, the restoration part, that's not all worked out yet either.
For kelp restoration to be effective, we need to be looking to take as many urchins as possible, like ideally close to 100%. And that way there's no urchins there to nibble away on the kelp that comes in, recruits into the area and recovers. So, you know, that's a big part of our work program, to understand and develop a protocol where we can be, you know, pragmatic in the removal, because at the end of the day, you know, we need to be removing them in a, you know, in a cost-effective way. You know, we need to pull in the right people into the tent to try and develop that protocol and understand what the best method is. So we don't know that yet, but that's a core piece of our puzzle.
And while Kelsey Miller's research has shown the potential benefits of kina removal,
kelp forests, even without those predators, are still really beneficial, because kelps on their own, you know, they are so important for habitat and that three-dimensional structure for the primary productivity, carbon sequestration, lots of things.
It has also underlined the challenges.
We spent 450 hours doing these removals.
Yeah.
So it works out to roughly 50 hours per hectare.
She and her colleagues spent those hours scuba diving, armed with hammers and steel pipes, cracking the kina on the reef, leaving spines and shattered shells in their wake.
Oof. That must have been full on. I guess you need permits for that kind of work, and iwi permission, because they are a kai moana taonga as well.
Yeah, both. The ka was a joint project with Ngāti Manuhiri and carried out with permission of another local iwi, Ngāi Tai Ki Tamaki. And you know, widespread killing of a taonga kai species like this does sit uneasily with many Māori. Ngāti Manuhiri spokesperson Delma O'Kane told me the decision to go ahead with the kāu was nuanced and informed by the iwi's approach to exercising kaitiakitanga. It wasn't easy for Kelsey either.
Did you find it hard, like, having to do it yourself?
I'm vegetarian. I don't like killing things. And it was a really, for me, it was a really rough experience.
Right.
Because it was like you were killing them and feeling bad about it and then feeling good, because you're like, oh, well, the fish are so happy. And you're like, oh, this is, like, hopefully good for the environment. And when the kelp grew back, I literally cried, because I was like, oh, at least it was worth it.
Yeah, that sounds intense. But also, I guess, she got her answer on whether it can be done, and it works.
It does, but only if you do it right.
For kelp restoration to happen, you have to remove almost all of the kina. And so that generally is less than one kina per square meter, which sounds like a lot, but compared to a lot of the kina barrens, there's often 4 or 5 per square meter, or up to 40 plus per square meter.
Wow. 40 per square meter. Oh, my God.
And I think that is something that we need to address, is for either harvesters, for urchinomics, or for direct consumption, it takes a lot of effort to harvest down to those levels. So it's easy to get a few of the kina and take the best ones that you want, and it takes a lot more effort to get every last one to be able to get those restoration benefits.
This is where commercial interests might clash with restoration goals, because it's time-consuming and therefore expensive to hunt down the last, say, 10% of kina. But if restoring kelp is the goal, you need to.
It's a tipping point. Once you get to a certain level, it takes quite a lot of kina to destroy a kelp forest. But once that's gone, only a few kina are able to maintain those barrens. So any new little kelps that try to grow up are just going to be destroyed.
Though the total allowable catch was increased significantly in October 2023 for the areas encompassing East Northland, Auckland, the Hauraki Gulf and the Bay of Plenty, this is unlikely to do anything to help. Because apart from the kinonomics team, no one wants to collect skinny kina. Right now, Johnny pays commercial quota holder Herb by the kilo every time he collects kina from a barren. Maybe, Kelsey says, we should consider creating something new.
Perhaps we could develop some type of restoration quota that community groups or commercial operators could apply for, and select an area of barrens to restore.
Kinonomics are hoping they could be granted some kind of long-term special harvesting permits that would require monitoring and verification of kelp recovery. Nothing like either of these exists right now, and the watchdog agency, Fisheries New Zealand, didn't seem all that enthusiastic when I tried to sound them out on it.
So where does this leave us?
Well, Johnny Wright told me they should have the results of this first stage of the Kinonomics pilot very soon. In the meantime, Kelsey's results are cause for a little bit of celebration.
When we started, we were pretty sure that the sites in Lee and at Hutoruotoi would show kelp regrowth. The site closest to Auckland at Otata Island and the Noisies chain, we weren't sure. There's a lot more sedimentation and turbidity. And after 6 months, we hadn't seen any kelp coming back. But then after 1 year, it was the highest kelp cover of any of the four sites. So Wow. It shows that it's possible across a big portion of the Gulf.
But we can't forget the bigger picture.
You mean the loss of those large snapper and crayfish that we put to the side, the ones that munch on kina and keep their numbers low?
Yeah, pulling kina out of an area can speed up the natural recovery. It helps you get ahead of the return of their natural predators. So you get kelp back in 2 years rather than, say, 20. But to really fix the problem, we need to remove the kina and then enable the big snapper and crayfish to come back to keep their numbers low. And that means changing how we fish.
That was science journalist Kate Evans, who researched and reported this story for New Zealand Geographic. She spoke to kina fisherman Peter Herbert and his son Todd Herbert, to Johnny Wright and Liam Hansard of Envirostrat, Kelsey Miller of the University of Auckland, Makoto Tokuyama of Kokoro Restaurant, and Ngāti Whātua kina lover Anahera Rauri. Voice of Tangaroa is a joint production between RNZ's Our Changing World and New Zealand Geographic. New Zealand Geographic reporting on the Voice of Tangaroa is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air. You can learn more and read the articles for free at nzgeo.com/seas. Kate Evans and Richard Robinson are the main journalist and photographer of the series, and additional reporting was done by Bill Morris. This episode was produced by Kate Evans and me, Claire Kincannon, with help from Ellen Rikers and Brianna Juritich. Thanks to Phil Vine for editing help. Sound engineering was by William Saunders, and executive producers are Tim Watkin of RNZ and James Frankham of New Zealand Geographic. Original music for this series was created by the Wellington-based group Grains. You can find them on Spotify. And you can find and follow Voice of Tangaroa on your favourite podcast platform, or you can follow Our Changing World. All episodes will also appear there. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and family. Help us get the word out. Tēnā koe I whakarongo mai. Thanks so much for listening. Ko Claire Kincannon aho, mā te wā.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.